Welcome to Sonic Artifacts, offering the best deals and interesting finds on affordable vintage music equipment in Los Angeles and New York City. This week on our interviewer series, we sit down with Matthew Farrow of Alexander Pedals. Building out of Garner, North Carolina, his designs take pedals into a new realm and have been used by tons of session musicians along with artists like Psychedelic Furs, My Morning Jacket, and Weasel Zappa. This is your host, Brian Shalomi, signing in from LA.
And your co-host, Max Braun, signing in from Brooklyn.
Matthew, thanks again for coming on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Awesome, man. So we were checking out, obviously, all your pedals on your website, which is super thorough, which I really, really appreciate. You even have manuals and everything on there, which is really cool.
Our stuff is a little on the complex tip, so a prospective buyer should have all the resources they would need. It really sucks, you know this, as a player, to buy something and then find out that it doesn't do the thing that you thought it did, or when you're trying to figure out how to do something, there's that information there. Also, all the manuals and the whole website are formatted for mobile as well. So when you go there on your phone at a gig and you're trying to remember how to save a preset on something, you can get to it. So it's kind of a double thing there. Just to give you some background, when I first started building pedals, I was building much more kind of hand-wired, one-at-a-time stuff. This is back in 2001. And that was fine. That was great. The state of the industry back then, that was pretty much the norm. You had guys like Fulltone, Zvex, Prescription Electronics. Those were the three brands that were available in my local guitar store that weren't Boss, Dunlop, DOD, right? So those guys were building stuff in that realm. If you look at the early sort of like P-Touch label, Fulltone stuff, it's a lot of pots wired with flying leads and not really anything designed for mechanical assembly. I started building stuff like that in the 2000s. And then in 2012, I designed and started building a line of MIDI controllers because I needed one. I needed a MIDI controller to go on my pedal board, and no one made anything that wasn't battleship sized or cost $400. So I was like, how hard can it be? It turns out kind of hard, but also kind of easy. So it kind of depends. But I started building these MIDI controllers, and they're not really something that you can hand wire, right? You need to have a circuit board in there. It's usually surface mount stuff. There's microcontrollers involved, and hand wiring that stuff with digital signals going around in there at high speeds is just it's a bad idea. So when I decided to revisit effects pedals in 2015, I took the stuff that I'd learned over the last 3-4 years of building MIDI controllers and applied that to building pedals. We started off with some, I don't want to say simple designs. We started off with some less complicated designs, still using digital technology. So the Spin FV1 chip, everyone has used it probably. Everyone in my segment of the market anyway has used it. And the Spin FV1, and we added stuff around it. It's a little bit limited, but if you want it to do more than that, if you want more than three knobs on it, you have to get crafty. And so the outgrowth of the current pedals we make was my attempt to take this sort of the heart of our previous pedals, the FV1 based pedals, and expand it and make it something that was greater than what you could do with an FV1. If you see a reverb or a delay pedal out there that has three knobs, then it's probably FV1 based, might be PT2399 belt and brick, but you know, three or four knobs and like a toggle switch to change modes, it's probably FV1 based. I've moved past that now. The product that we're launching next week is significantly more complex while feeling less complex. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but I didn't intend to make complicated, weird programmable pedals. I just wanted to make something cool. And we started building these pedals and we sold hundreds of them, and they just felt limiting. They just felt like I could be doing more. So I took a step up, added some co-processing, some extra circuitry to them, just in an attempt to break out of three knobs and a switch.
Is that where disaster area designs comes in terms of the chipboards and things like that? Because obviously that at that point you're getting into manufacturing, you know, you're out of your breadboard world in your room at that point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When I started disaster area designs, when I actually started doing the MIDI controllers in 2012, I had already been doing PCB layout and design for manufacture with my day job. So I was working in the environmental sciences industry, and I was designing products for my company. And so I had, by that point, you know, between the 10 years when I started building boost pedals in a spare bedroom and I started building the MIDI controllers, I had gotten 10 years experience doing this better. And so when it came time to do the disaster area stuff, I already knew how to lay out a board. I already knew how to program a microcontroller. I already knew how to do all of these things. And it was, why would I go back? Why would I go back to breadboard stuff when I already knew how to do boards? So I leveraged what I had already learned doing boards. So when it came time to do the disaster area stuff, it was a really easy decision. It's like, oh, let's lay out a board. And I built the first 200 of them by hand, which was not super fun, but it's not impossible to do. And then once I realized that these were going to be a growing concern, that I was going to be selling more and more of these, I went to the vendor that we used at my day job to build boards. And I said, hey, can you build my boards too? Can you build my, you know, this hobby for me? Can you do those? And they're like, well, sure. Well, you know, we don't care. We'll build anybody's board, you know, pay us. And the first 200 I built by hand myself in my garage. My wife jokes that I would be out in the garage watching Mythbusters, because I had a had a computer out there, and I had like an old crappy, I don't know, probably Pentium 4 probably. And so I would just like queue up 5 episodes of Mythbusters and just build pedals all Saturday. My life at that point was going to work like 8 to 5, 8 to 6 every day, and coming home and doing school stuff. So I was going to school at night for my bachelor's. And then every weekend I would build the orders that had come in the previous week. So I'd get orders in all week. And at first it was like 2-3 pedals. It's like, oh, I can do this. And then it was like 8. And then it was like 25. And I got to the point where I couldn't build my week's orders in the weekend, not even Saturday and Sunday. And then it's like, well, I either need to like step it up or pull it back, because I can't keep taking people's money and not delivering stuff to them, because eventually they'll get super mad. You know, when it got to a 3-4 week turnaround time on this stuff, it was like, I can't really justify this. It's not, as a customer, I would feel upset by this. So I had to make a decision at that point. And then PayPal kind of made my decision for me in 2012, they changed the rules so that if you received over $20,000 and 200 transactions over PayPal, they were going to send the IRS a 1099-K, which is it's a tax form that says you earned this much money. And at that point, you have to start paying income tax on it. And I looked at my PayPal and I realized I had sold $80,000 worth of controllers.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, shit. So my decision was very much made for me. There was a whole lot of stuff that happened in my life, right? Like in 2012. And I knew it was going to be, I knew I had to do it. I at least try it. And my wife is incredibly supportive. And she said, you should go for it. And even though she worries because it's not a real job, it wasn't a real job. It was just me and my dog in a building pedals. Within 6 months, I'd hired an employee, and within a year I'd hired 2 more. And now we're up to 10, and we're in a 5,000 square foot building, and we do really well. So we're amazingly successful. I feel incredibly blessed, or incredibly lucky, or whatever combination it is of those things. So yeah, some of it is because I'm good, but a lot of it is because I get right time, right place a lot. That seems to happen to people who are successful in this industry. It seems to happen a lot. There's a lot of right time, right place. But yeah, by the time I started doing Alexander pedals, I'd already made, I don't know, 1,000 MIDI controllers. So I knew what not to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like you said, I mean, you were making pedals since early 2000s. So at that point, I mean, you're 10, 12 years in, you're 20 years in into building.
I remember something about that time with PayPal going on too. I remember I used to pay my landlord with PayPal, and at some point he made me stop.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they changed the fee structure as well. So there was a lot of stuff going on, and PayPal exists to make money, and they make money by facilitating paying between two people and charging you a fee on it. And we have a pretty good PayPal rate because we do, I mean, like no lie, hundreds of thousands of dollars PayPal a year. So our rate is like 2.625 or something. It's pretty good. But like when you think about hundreds of thousands of dollars times 2.625%, it's not zero. We do about 50-50 PayPal and Stripe. So we offer both services on the website. So depending on how your accounts are set up, and there's different gateways, so people in different countries might not like to use PayPal. There's a bunch of like kind of like we would consider them like weird oddball payment services that exist in other countries that are perfectly normal there. But the cool thing is that generally with Stripe, they're accepted. Stripe is it's the founders are Irish, and so they're a little more Euro focused than PayPal, whose founders are Americans or lived in America, I should say.
I heard Stripe is a really badass company, actually.
Stripe have been incredible to work with in terms of issues we've had with them. It's basically zero. And that's over 6 years in like seriously millions of dollars of transactions with Stripe. They've got a thing called Radar, which is a fraud detection and prevention. And it's very well implemented so that if someone gives you some kind of if you have a weird thing going on, things not matching, IP addresses not being where they're expected, it tends to weed them out so that you're not left holding the bag. And again, we've had exactly one bad transaction on Stripe in 6 years, exactly one. And it was because I didn't have any of the Radar stuff turned on. I didn't know it was a thing. Oh. And so, yeah. So a guy bought some dude bought three pedals, and we shipped them, and then he did a chargeback and was like, "You're screwed. There's $600." Yeah.
Oh man.
So money I did not have at the time, but it worked out. So, but yeah, we do, the whole thing with this has been very much like, I tend to just do stuff that I wanted for myself, and then other people give me money to buy it. So I've been really fortunate. I haven't done many things that have been like aimed squarely at other people and not aimed at myself. There's a few things, but generally speaking, if I do something, it's because I wanted it for me.
Right. That's the main source of inspiration, is your need at that point. And I'm taking it to.
Yeah, generally. Yeah.
There's quite a few Alexander pedals that are out. Which was the first one that you came out with?
The first one was called Amnesia, and it's a vintage style delay. So it's was three different flavors of analog sounding delay. So I got three different analog delay pedals, and I looked at what's the frequency response and how long is the delay time and what does it sound like when they start to get crunchy. And I did my best to emulate and simulate that. And I was like, oh, this is cool. I can do this. And I came up with some art that was vaguely inspired by the Memory Man. And I was like, this is going to be our pedal. And then I sent it to a buddy of mine that always helps me make these kinds of decisions. And he was like, well, this is great, but I can't get a clear sounding repeat out of it. And I was like, it's analog. It's not supposed to be clear. And he's like, I know, but I can't get a clear sounding repeat out of it. And I'm like, oh, okay, screw you. So I designed the Radical Delay, which is very digital, very bright, very clear. Clinically so. It's you know? And then I was like, well, now that I have this clear sounding delay, what can I do with it? And I was like, oh, well, I can put a pitch shifter on it. I can put a bit crusher on it. And I could put a modulating thing on it. So I sent that to him and he's like, okay, this is better, but it's super weird. No one's going to buy this. I'm like, okay, that's cool. Maybe I'll just offer it. And if no one buys it, no one buys it. It's fine. And then we got an email from Pro Guitar Shop, from Tom Keithley at Pro Guitar Shop. And he said, hey, I've been following you on Instagram. Checked out what you did. The owner of the company is very interested in working with you. Would you like to send us a pedal to demo? And I said, you mean Andy will demo it? And I'm like, okay, sure. So I sent them a radical delay and Andy Martin did a demo of it and it went crazy. So we ended up getting a distributor, and through the distributor, we ended up with, I think, half a dozen dealers within a week. And the 100 boards we had built all of a sudden wasn't enough. So we'd sold out of, because at the time the line was 4 pedals and 3 of them used the same board. We had one pedal that was a different design. It was analog. It was a boost pedal. And then we had 3 that were digital with this FV1 board. And so we had 100 of those digital ones built. And between the 3 different SKUs, they all got bought up within 10 days, 2 weeks at the most.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was like, oh, okay, well, I mean, now I have money to buy the rest of, to buy more, but it's like, okay, I didn't anticipate this. And so the pedals did pretty well. But it wasn't until we released the Sky-Fi that I would say had a bona fide hit. The Sky-Fi was the first pedal we released that was something people were actively buying in big numbers. We sold, I think 400 in the first quarter, which was a lot for us. A lot. We're pretty small. We're smaller than you think we are. We have a presence like a big pedal company, but you know, when you look at, say, when Chase Bliss goes, oh, we're going to do a limited run of 1,000. And I laugh at that because most of the pedals we built, we've never sold 1,000 of. You know, we've broken 1,000 on Syntax Error and the Jubilee and probably pretty soon the Color Theory. But like we only sell 2,000 pedals a year. So when someone's like, everything we make is way more limited than everyone else. So our stuff is way more boutique than you think it is. You know, when I think about Josh Scott's got a whole thing about what is boutique, and you know, his stuff is less boutique than mine. One of the things I consider to be boutique is the amount of handwork that goes into building a pedal. So how many minutes or hours does it take a human being to touch things to go in the pedal to make it complete? And one of our pedals is 20 minutes. One of his pedals is about 4. And so his stuff is less boutique than ours. Boss, interestingly, is more boutique than ours because there's a lot more. Seriously, dude, there's a whole thing. I was really fortunate to meet and get to hang out with Yoshi Ikigami, who's the president of Boss. He's an amazingly cool dude. He's also hilarious, even though English is definitely not his first language. He's hilarious. And he started at Boss in the late 80s, early 90s, doing the like higher end rack mount digital stuff. And he's worked his way up to be president, but he's very cool. But Boss have this whole thing of this, like, they have a factory. Yeah. But there's like one guy who paints everything and he's got like a color sample that he holds up. He's like, this looks like the right yellow for an SD1. He's like, mixes all the paint by hand. And then every Boss pedal, they touch it to this lucky rock before it leaves the building. I'm serious. It's awesome.
That's crazy.
It's the most amazing thing. But yeah, we started with the Amnesia, Radical Delay, Equilibrium. And then the next round was F13, Jubilee, La Calavera, History Lesson, Space Expander, Waveland, Golden Summer. That was all in the first, those like 9 pedals were all in the first basically 12 months. We started with 4 and then pretty quickly the line doubled to 8. And then the Sky-Fi was 2017, I guess, Winter NAMM of 2017. And then the syntax error was summer NAMM of 2017. So the syntax error, so we went from like three knobs in a switch to full MIDI control, presets, expression, all that within 2 years. Just, you know, we make MIDI controllers. So people were asking, why don't your pedals have MIDI? I was like, oh, well, because I don't think anyone wants that. People don't want MIDI on their pedals. They want like normal pedals. I was wrong.
Yeah,
I was wrong. People definitely want MIDI. And as, and I hate to be like this, but we were kind of the first guys to really go after the compact MIDI controller market. Tech 21 had the MIDI mouse, but it's super limited. It only sends program changes and it's super limited and they're really cool. But at the time that they came out, no one needed that. No one had MIDI on their pedal boards. They had a rack and it had a bunch of stuff in it. And by the time you're hauling around a rack, an 8 or 10 or 12 U rack with, you know, six things in it, you probably need a big MIDI controller. What we discovered is that people wanted small MIDI controllers for their pedal boards rather than like a giant, like FCB 1010. I can't even, my camera angle isn't wide enough for you guys to see this, but my hands are 2.5 feet apart. So we did MIDI controllers that were like the size of a timeline. The first ones we made were 7x4. And then people are like, well, this is cool, but can you make it smaller? And so then they were 4x3, and then they were, you know, 4.7x2.6. And our most popular MIDI controller now is like 4x2. It's tiny. It's the size of a Twinkie, right? It's like, you know, it's a super small pedal, and that's our most popular design, the DMC Micro. We sell thousands of those things. Between the Micro and the Micro Pro, we sell thousands of them. Because the other thing that I don't know if people understand, or I don't want to presume, but the thing I didn't understand was that going after the big guys, the pros, the guys who have complicated rigs, that's fine. And there's definitely a place for that. But there's many, many more people who play in their bedrooms. And I feel like, especially with the more technological stuff at the time, anyway, in the early 2010s, through the 2010s, that the guys making MIDI controllers were more focused on the big stuff, right? It's like, let me sell this $500 MIDI controller to you. And we were getting a lot of requests from people that are like, well, this is great, but it's too big, or it does too much, or it's too complicated. What do you have that's easier, simpler, cheaper, smaller? And so we've shrunk and simplified rather than the other. So what we're finding is that it's a lot easier to make a big impact when you're selling small things to hobbyists, or not even hobbyists, just people who play for fun, for love. It's really cool to go after the big dudes, because then you have this kind of like bragging right to say, oh, I sold a pedal to insert name of famous player. But I would rather be like, well, I sold 45 controllers while you were busy pursuing this guy. Like,
right.
You know,
right.
Which one's more valid? I don't know that one is more valid, but for me, trying to pay my overhead and my employees, selling 40 controllers is way more valid than selling one, regardless of what right. the price happens to be. So I will continue to go after the, you know, the small part of the market, because it's the small part is bigger.
Yeah.
It seems it's counterintuitive, but like, I don't know how valuable a big celebrity endorsement is anymore to someone who's selling a pedal. Like, have you ever bought a pedal because like, you know, Vernon Reed played it, or Joe Bonamassa, or Slash, or Yngwie Malmsteen? Cause I never have. I've never bought a pedal because it was, you know, I mean, I've certainly bought some signature model guitars because I liked them, but I've bought signature model guitars of players that I'm not super into just because they're cool guitars.
I was going to ask, how was the effect of pandemic, you know, with your sales and things like that? Has that affected the business in any way the last year?
Sales increased.
Awesome.
Nice.
So here's another thing, and this is unrelated or semi-related, when we started doing disaster area, we were buying enclosures and we were buying ones that were pre-finished. They were powder coated. There was a company in Oklahoma at the time that was specialized and they sold enclosures. And if you bought 10 of them, you could have them powder coated. So they would powder coat them and wrap them up and send them to you. And it wasn't cheap, but the resulting finish was way better than anything we could do. Like compared to say spray paint or whatever, it was, the resulting finish was excellent. And so we would get these enclosures in and we would drill them and put all of our parts in them and ship them out. And when we started to get busier, all of a sudden we couldn't get enough of these powder coated enclosures from these guys. We're like, well, I need 4 of this and 7 of this and 9 of this. And they're like, well, it's going to be 4 weeks. And I'm like, you know, now I'm screwed. End of 2013, we moved into a new building, a bigger building. And I put in a powder coating setup. So we had a little oven and a booth that has fume extraction. Powder coating is an electrostatic process. Basically, you have this a plastic powder. It's finely ground. It's like confectioner sugar. It's like fine little granules. And you spray it through this gun with compressed air. So you blow it through this gun. And at the end of the gun, there's a little electrode. I'm holding up my finger for those at home listening. There's an electrode. It's like a little piece of wire, basically. And it has a very high voltage charge on it, like in the thousands of volts. There's no current. It won't kill you, but it'll give you a nice little sting. But it puts a charge on these particles. And then you spray it at a piece of metal that's grounded. And so the grounding has a charge of 0 and the powder has a charge of negative 30,000 volts. And they stick together because of the difference in charge. So you spray it on stuff and it kind of looks like you pull a Dorito out of the bag, right? And it's got that red powder all over it, right? It looks kind of like that. And then you take that and you put it in the oven, not the Dorito, the pedal, and the powder will flow out. It'll melt and all the individual granules will fuse together and they'll stick to the metal. And then when you take it out, you have this durable, very tough coated finish. So it's the same stuff that goes on outdoor furniture, brake calipers. Trying to think what else is powder coated. A lot of outdoor equipment, tool handles, things like that. It's a really durable finish and it's really environmentally friendly because there's no solvents. There's no chemicals that dissolve the solids into a liquid. Like with regular paint, with wet paint, it's nasty because there's solvents. It's why Fender has a hard time spraying paint in California, right? Because you have to have water filtration and all this stuff to do that and have it be environmentally friendly. Powder coating is way more because it's just dust. Like you could eat a tablespoon of it. Your poop would be real gross, but you would live because it's inert. It's not I wouldn't do a line of it, but it won't kill you if it gets in your skin or in a cut or something. It's inert, right? So it's very environmentally friendly compared to most other finishing methods. So we put in this powder coat booth and we started powder coating our enclosures. And it was nice because we could drill them first and then powder coat them. So we didn't have to worry about drilling already painted metal. And mm-hmm. that took away a problem with our supply chain. And then after we'd been doing that for about a year, I bought a CNC milling machine because we had been drilling everything by hand. We had a manual mill for cutting out the square windows for our displays. And so I got the CNC milling machine and I was like, oh my God, this is I think it was $14,000. It's like, there's no way this will never pay for itself. I've made a terrible mistake. It paid for itself basically in the first year. So, I mean, we were still paying on the lease, but by the time we had a mill and a powder coat set up, I bought a UV printer, which is another $30,000 or whatever, $27,000. We were able to make complete pedals. And so we sold those pedals to other people. So we would sell these jobs. We worked with a bunch of other pedal companies who were also having supply chain issues. And so we drilled, powder coated, and printed all these other pedals and sold them to, I'm trying to think of ones that, Caroline Guitar Company, Bondi, So Bondi Effects in Sydney, Australia. I'm just trying to think of the folks that Dr. Scientist, these are all people that acknowledge the job we do for them. There's a bunch of other companies that we do stuff for, but we don't say that we do stuff for.
Right.
Because
that's a contractual thing. Talk in advance. You guys talk about that.
Yeah. Basically if we have your permission to say we do your enclosures, then we will. But, Daredevil, we do all the enclosures for Daredevil. So we do enclosures for a lot of companies, and that's become, when we first started, it was a really tiny part of our business. And now it is somewhere between a third and half our business, depending on the month and the, you know, what else, whatever else is going on. So it's really strange to me that it used to be disaster area was 85% of our business. Disaster area hasn't gotten any smaller. It's gotten a bit bigger. I'm moving my fingers further apart. So it's gotten a bit bigger. Alexander's gotten a lot bigger. It gets bigger every year. So back in March, when everything was all locked down, we saw our enclosure sales plummet because the people that were buying these enclosures all of a sudden weren't buying them because they couldn't get into work and build stuff. And then we were down to like, I don't know, we had like 300 in the backlog. And then in maybe June, when people started to figure things out a little bit better, stuff started to open back up in a limited way. We had this huge crush of enclosures. I mean, we did 15,000 enclosures last year.
Jesus.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's an incredible angle to the business. I mean, you've literally started a factory, you know, in a way you needed it, as like you said, you needed this, MIDI controller that could fit on your pedal board. You needed someone to build the enclosures, paint them, and you became the guy. And now everyone else is coming to you. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Like what we figured out is that a powder coating setup costs about $3,000, right? It's not stupid expensive, but it's not free either. Like the powder coating gun is about $600, and then you need a booth, and that's like another, you know, $1,800, $2,000, and then an oven is about another grand. So $5,000 all in would get you a really nice powder coating setup for pedals, right? And it's all stuff that is obtainable. If you want to spend more on it, you absolutely can. Like our ovens are very small. They're tabletop ovens. They work great. And they're easy to replace. If one of them breaks down, I can get another one in a couple of days. Like I don't need to call a guy to come and fix it. I'll just throw it away and get another one. It's an oven. There's not much to it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But what I figured out is that if you have a guy who's building pedals, right, he's soldering things, screwing things together, assembling stuff, that's a certain skill set, right? And you train this guy or girl to do that job. And once they get proficient at it, they're good at it. And when they build stuff, they can make enough product to pay for their wages, right? They can build X number of dollars of stuff an hour. If you then ask them to stop doing that and go do something else, every time you ask someone to change jobs, it's not very efficient. Like every time you ask someone to like stop doing what you're doing and go and do this other task, every time you have to change a task like that, you lose some productivity because you have to stop and start, and you know, it's like you can't go do A and then B and then C. You should really just be doing A and then B, 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 C, C, C. So even like on a micro level, when you're building pedals, it's almost always faster to do all of one task on a batch of pedals than it is to build a pedal complete. Because every time you put down a tool or pick up a different tool, you lose some productivity. And also you take yourself out of that rhythm. So you can get into this rhythm where you're very productive. When you're doing the powder coating stuff, the skills that are necessary to do the powder coating are very different than the skills that are necessary to build a pedal. So hiring a person to build pedals and then being like, oh, by the way, go powder coat stuff is a waste of everyone's time. It's way better to have a guy or girl who's just really good at powder coating stuff and have them do that all day. Well, I've never once needed a person who can, I've never needed enough enclosures to pay someone to powder coat my enclosures all day. So if I wanted someone to just do my enclosures every day, I have enough work for them to do about an hour a day, because by the time you set up the powder gun and powder everything and bake everything off and clean everything back down. It's about an hour. So what do they do for the other 7 hours? Right. It's just, it's not like no one wants to work part-time doing a job like that. It sucks. So what we do is we sell the rest of their time to other people. So I need an hour a day, and that's not even really an hour a day. That's 15 minutes a day spread out over a week. And so it ends up being, 2 hours, 3 hours a week. But there's a lot of other companies that use the same color powder we do. So we'll often just tack one of our jobs onto job for another customer or vice versa. Like if a customer, like Analog Endeavors, we do a lot of like little foot switches and controller boxes for them. And so when they want stuff that's black texture, it's our number one powder, we'll tack their job onto ours or our job onto theirs, depending on which one's bigger. And that way, we don't waste the time. Cause when you're done powder coating something, you have to clean everything really thoroughly. So you don't end up with like glitter in your solid or black specks in your white powder or anything like that. So you have to like, you spend a lot of time cleaning. So that's the real time. Cause you can shoot a bar of enclosures. It'd be 4 or 8 enclosures in about 6 minutes. You can do an entire oven worth. So like 12 enclosures in 10 or 15 minutes. And then it's a 20-minute job to clean everything down.
So if they're like, hey, I got some black mat, whatever for one company. It's like, okay, well, we got these other companies. They had a couple black orders. You got some black orders. That's a day's work for black.
Exactly. And we're at the point now where a day's work for the powder coating guys is like, 300 boxes, which is crazy. Like
that's a lot of freaking pedals.
We're gonna grow the enclosure side of the business like 75% this year.
Wow.
So
you didn't see this coming, I guess.
Nope, not even close. Yeah. Not even close. Yeah. We right time, right place. We started doing it, and we're good, and we're generally pretty fast. We're not cheap. So we're definitely not the cheapest out there. But we're good and we're fast.
It's super cool, man. I mean, as far as your actual designs of the artwork have like a pretty unique look with it's kind of like a Atari kind of video game angle, some of them. How did that come about? Do you have a graphic designer in house, or like how does that work?
The first like 10 pedals were all me. I did all the first everything up to Syntax Error. I did all those and F13 and Color Theory. So in I guess December of 17, we had a coloring contest because I thought it would be fun because I'm a dork like that. And so I put on our Instagram just a black and white line drawing of a Syntax Error. And I was like, color me to win. And basically we had this coloring contest, and all you had to do was color it and scan it in, or color it on your device, whatever, and put it on your Instagram and use the hashtag. And so I just went and grabbed the 4 that I liked the best, and I put them up and I let people vote. And as a thank you to the 4 winners, I made one of each of the 4 semifinalist ones. And then the 2 top ones, we actually made limited runs of both of those. So one of the guys that did the coloring contest made a really cool, it's the Castlevania version. And I'm sure you've probably, if you look around, if you look up Syntax Castlevania, I'm pretty sure that's the first thing that pops up. And so the guy who did that coloring contest, who won and did this, the Castlevania version, turns out to be local to me. So it turns out that of all the weird random people on the internet who enter this contest, this is a guy that lives 15 minutes from my shop.
That's wild.
And so I was like, do you want a job? He's like, well, no, I freelance, but like, I wouldn't say no to some contract work. And so he, subsequent to that, he has done most of the pedals in the line.
I like the hot pink a lot.
Yeah, me too. It has that.
That's a cool one.
Yeah. Very Rad Racer vibe. We specifically made the art of the sun on that. So for those of you who go and just Google Alexander Hot Pink, I promise it won't bring up anything terrible. But there's a there's a very, you know, 1980s kind of triangle logo. And then at the top of the pedal, there's a, it's the back of the Ferrari from Rad Racer. I think it's actually the one from Outrun, from like the ZX Spectrum version, the black and white. And it's driving into the setting sun. And in the 80s, the setting sun was represented with a, like a gradient. So it'd be like a big circle. It was like yellow at the top and orange and then red at the bottom. And this is all just black and white. So it almost looks like, with the placement of the LED on the pedal, it almost looks like you're driving into the Death Star. So it has that, that vibe.
That's awesome. Yeah. They don't even notice that. Now I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh, you're right. That is the,
yeah. So basically anything in the discontinued pedals section I designed, and then I did the older stuff. So like La Calavera, Defender, the Rift, the Jubilee, F13, Color Theory, Syntax Error, History Lesson. So the older stuff I did and the newer stuff he did. Anything that looks like it's a copy of the art on something else, probably me. That's generally where I go. I'm really good at copying other people's art and not so good at making it my own. So that's 100% on me. But Serge does all the other stuff, and his aesthetic is, I mean, you know, he's a graphic designer, so he kind of does what he's told, but he does it in a, he executes it in a really, really good way. And generally I just give him a vibe. I say, make it look like this. So for like the marshmallow, I said breakfast cereal, and he was like, he was like, okay, I know what to do. And so if you look at the marshmallow, it really does look like the cover of a box of cereal. It looks like the, you know, it looks like marshmallows and stars, or, you know, it definitely has a Saturday morning cartoon vibe. And that's what I was going for. We get a lot of, our art is very polarizing. There are a lot of people who think it's great and a lot of people who think it's terrible, and no one who is in the middle. And so what I figured out is that the people that are complaining about the art, going, well, it's too cartoony, it's too garish or too bright, too colorful, whatever, whatever the reason they have for not liking the art, I've figured out that those people are probably not going to buy the pedal no matter what the art looks like, because generally our stuff sounds like the way it looks. So if you look at one of our pedals, they tend to be pretty representative. Like if you look at a marshmallow, it really does sound exactly the way it looks. So you weren't going to buy it anyway. And why would I listen to someone who's not going to buy it? Why would I, why would I make a marketing decision based on someone who's not buying it?
Right. Non-consumers.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you got to go, you have to kind of temper that. And there's also the, you know, the complainer aspect of it. Like people love to,
of course,
people love to bitch and complain about stuff. Sometimes their complaints are valid and sometimes they're not. I tend to kind of filter any kind of overly negative or overly positive feedback I get, because, you know, it does cut both ways. There's plenty of people out there who will say your stuff is great, and then they don't, they don't mean it, or they would say something different if you weren't in front of them. So I tend to be a little bit, I tend to filter the stuff a little bit. What I found is that when we tried to do the historical reference side of things, we were not successful. We sold stuff, yes, but we didn't sell the kind of numbers that really made it. Like Alexander survived for the sort of 2 years because we had the disaster area money coming in, right? It was like, we never lost money with Alexander. We've never lost money with anything, but we never lost money with Alexander. But if that was my only job, it would be a hobby, right? And then when we started to get more successful with it, you know, when we were graduating from the hundreds of pedals a year to the thousands of pedals sort of tier, then it became different. But the things that helped us get to that thousands of pedals a year tier were stopping, were no longer focusing on vintage recreations of anything. It's never like my version of a blah, blah, blah. No, I had this MIDI verb that I thought was cool and it broke. And I was like, I really need that sound again. How do I get it? Well, it turns out it's not that hard. If you know how the MIDI verb algorithm is constructed, then you can kind of go back and create your own version of it. And so the SkyFi is basically the algorithm from my MIDI Verb 2 and my take on that algorithm. It's, you know, the way the guy that designed the MIDI Verb 2 is also the guy that designed the FV1 chip. And so if you just look at how the MIDI Verb hardware is designed, you can figure out how the reverb algorithms are made, because the way the hardware was designed, you could only make them one way because it's hardware. And I just approximated that in software, and we had this thing and people started going nuts for it. I had this pedal called Robots that I made for me. And it was like the stuff that's in the Syntax Era, right? It was in this Robots. It was like a bit crusher and a ring mod that had a sample and hold on it. And the cubic distortion. I had those three things. And I was like, well, the Robots is cool, but then there's 9 other pedals that have some kind of robot thing in the name. Like there was I don't think the Dirty Robot was out yet, but there were a bunch of, there's like the Robo Talk, and there were a bunch of things. And I was like, we'll never get a pedal called Robots out without someone sending us a letter about it. So right. I was like, okay, what can I do? And I was like, well, let me go back to the Commodore roots and you'll just call it Syntax Error. And as soon as I knew we were going to have a pedal called Syntax Error, I was like, I know what this sounds like. So I started designing it. And what I found was that the pedal was designed like our other pedal. So it had 4 knobs. It's like 3 parameters and then a mix knob and then a toggle switch that changed the modes. And every pedal we'd done previous to that, basically they have like 3 knobs in common across all the modes. And then there'd be like 1 knob that was something different. So for a delay, it would be like the delay time and the repeats and the mix would be common because those are what you need in a delay. And then the 4th knob would be like the modulation amount or the pitch shift amount or the whatever. It'd be the extra thing. And so when you would go back and forth between modes, you'd probably only have to tweak like 1 knob, maybe 2 knobs to get a usable sound. Well, the Syntax Error, every knob in every mode was something radically different from everything else. And so you'd flip the switch and then you'd have to spend sort of a minute dicking around with these knobs to try to get it to sound like you wanted. And I was like, you know, we should do some presets on here. Like there's got to be a way to do some presets. And so we were going to NAMM, and I don't remember what the pedal was going to be for NAMM at the time. I had some drive pedal. I forgot. Anyway, not important. And I had the Syntax Error. And so with 2 weeks to go before NAMM, I designed a new board, sent out for prototypes, brought it back in, re-engineered the entire thing, wrote all the code for it, got it all worked, did the art, got it all working. And I want to say the day before left for NAMM, I built like 2 of them. We had 4 at the show. We had 4 pedals at the show. And so the last 2 I built, like, I think we left on Wednesday morning. And I think Tuesday afternoon, I built the last 2. I've still got all the prototypes. One of them has a white button and all of them, the art is different than the current version, but they all worked, even though there were a bunch of like crazy spaghetti wires inside to try to like fix things that were wrong on the board. We had put it up on Instagram, done a bunch of teasers, and like the day of the first day of NAMM, we had revealed it, and just it went crazy. We didn't have any demos up. We didn't, like, Andy didn't have one. We didn't have any media, nothing. And we just had a big banner. It was like Syntax Error. And we had like Nashville session guys, like pedal steel guys, and like, you know, crazy, like Ray Stevens guitar player, who's really cool, by the way, came to the booth and was like, show me the Syntax Error. I'm like, don't you think you would prefer this vintage style, you know, echo delay?
Reverb, yeah.
And it was like, nope. Show me the Syntax Error. And I'm like, wild. I'm like, why? He goes, well, you know how many times I go to a session and the producer goes, okay, that was great. Now, can you make it not sound like a guitar? I was like, oh shit.
I mean, you guys found your lane, which is hard in the sea of pedal builders
today.
It
really is. You know what I mean? Yeah, I think it really is. And at first it was like, well, let's do like one weird one and then we'll do a normal one because I want to sell more pedals, but no one buys the normal ones. They buy Walrus or Keeley, you know, like why would you buy an Alexander normal pedal? Because we're good at the weird stuff. So let's just focus on that.
What is the name of this new pedal that's coming out?
The Syntax Error 2.
The two. Yeah. Okay.
So it's got, all right. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's stereo in and out, and it's got an OLED display in the middle. So one of the things that's challenging about the pedals we make now is that basically you've got a foot switch and you know, like a button in the middle and four knobs and then just LEDs. And so if you're colorblind, it's really hard to tell, you know, oh, well it's yellow when it does this and it's purple when it does this. Man, if you,
I'm a little colorblind.
Yeah. So, yeah. 10% of men are colorblind in some way, less than 1% of women are colorblind. I've got two people in my shop who are colorblind. Anything we do that relies on colors to indicate things, I've really tried to get away from that. Or if we do, I try to use red and blue because red and blue are at the total opposite ends of the spectrum from each other.
Well, I have to mention Alexander Pedals is named after your late brother and that every portion of profit goes toward ending childhood cancer, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. So I would like to touch on that. We've got a couple of things, we do. The biggest recipient of our donations right now is an organization called Camp Carefree. And they are a camp for kids with cancer, not only cancer, but also cystic fibrosis and spina bifida, as well as their siblings. And I was one of the sibling campers in their very first session. So the very first year they operated, and it was really nice, you know, for those folks out there who've had chronically ill siblings or parents or children, you'll understand this. But when you are the sibling of someone with cancer, everything in your life revolves around taking care of that other person. Everything. Your mom, you know, our mom became a nurse, you know, our dad became a nurse. We basically all lived on a cancer ward for 3 years, and it becomes really hard to even remember what normal is like. You know, everything is about that sick person, and that's how it should be. But when I was, you know, said 8 years old, 9 years old, to be able to go away for a week to summer camp where you're just a normal kid with a bunch of other kids who understood what it was like to be the brother or sister of the kid with cancer was one of the greatest gifts that anyone ever gave me, is to be normal for a week. And when I found out that their annual operating budget was as low as it is, I said, you know what? St. Jude doesn't need my, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 a year, but Camp Carefree could really use it. So I reached out to them and said, hey, can we give you money? And they said, please give us money. So we've been able to provide them with donations. We've been doing that for the last 2 years. Prior to that, it was St. Jude, and St. Jude is great, but St. Jude's fundraising budget is more than Camp Carefree's operating budget. So the amount of money that St. Jude spends on things like reaching out to donors and television commercials is higher than what Camp Carefree spends in an entire year. It's not even like, you know, neck and neck. It's like an order of magnitude difference. So I decided to focus on a charity that had a personal connection to me and my life, as well as one that means a lot to hundreds, thousands of other kids, parents, siblings. And so we're able to get a lot more good done with our dollars than we would if we were donating to a bigger charity. And then the other charity that we donate to is the Trevor Project, which is probably more familiar to a lot more people. But the Trevor Project is a charity that helps at-risk LGBTQ youth. So it provides things like counseling and mental health advocacy and suicide prevention and help for those people, because life is rough for everybody, but it's a lot more rough when there's people out there telling you that what you are is wrong. And I think that anything that I can do to help make that a less shitty thing, I should do.
And again, I really appreciate you coming on the show and telling us about, you know, there's so much more to the business that I didn't even understand. I'm sure our listeners are going to really appreciate that. And you're really helping a lot of the other builders that are all part of this aftermarket renaissance, like a golden age in parts and building we have right now. You know, the donations to those charities is really, really special. And you definitely walk the walk and talk the talk, man. So thank you again so much for coming on the show.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Matthew, have an awesome day, man. Really appreciate that.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Max.
Definitely, man.
All right. Peace.
Folks, we'll have all the links to their Instagram, the website, everything going on, just for you to check out. And that concludes this week's edition of our interview series here at Sonic Artifacts. Remember to please hit the subscribe button on your favorite streaming platform.
And catch us every Tuesday for the best deals in affordable vintage music equipment in Los Angeles and New York City.
This is your host, Brian Chalubby, signing off from LA.
And your co-host, Max Braun, signing off from New York.
Get you on Tuesday.